even the new Seattle hockey team, because it's never going to meet its transit goals for the new arena in Queen Anne.
Well, that is the Seattle Kraken. And I must remind you, they also were exploring delivering people to the arena by drone. So that will absolutely be
I didn't know about
their podcast. Hi, and welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. We're coming to you from GeekWire in Seattle, where we report each day on what's happening around us in technology, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, and every week on this show, we talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. This week, a group of downtown Seattle business and nonprofit leaders announced on Thursday that they will be introducing a ballot measure to address the city's chronic homelessness problem. If it makes the ballot and is approved by voters, the Compassion Seattle Charter Amendment would require the city to provide a battery of shelters and services for thousands of the city's homeless. It would also require the city to keep public spaces like parks and playgrounds free of homeless encampments once the required housing, mental health, and drug programs are in place. The problem of homelessness has been cited by many Seattle tech companies who worry about the safety of their employees. Some have even started to move out of downtown Seattle, relocating to nearby cities like Bellevue and Kirkland. We're joined this week by GeekWire's Mike Lewis, who reported our story on this new initiative. And we're also joined by Scott Moore, a longtime Seattle entrepreneur and CEO of AdLightning, a startup that left its downtown offices last March, partly due to the pandemic, but also because of the homelessness situation in Seattle. Scott and Mike, welcome to the GeekWire podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
So, Mike, let's start with you. You had the story this week kind of setting the scene on this new initiative that's going on in downtown Seattle related to the homelessness crisis. What's actually going on here?
What's specifically going on is an amendment to the city charter. And if you don't know what a city charter is, it's essentially a city's constitution. It's the thing that delineates there's a parks department, there's a police department, blah, on and on and on. That is something that you need to go to the voters to amend, and at least under Seattle's city charter. So this group of folks from nonprofits who deal with the homeless population in Seattle to some local business organizations like the Downtown Association all decided to get together to create a charter amendment, which would rewrite the city's charter in one portion and put some very specific goals to the city that it has to meet to deal with the homeless population, which obviously has been an issue in Seattle for years now and really doesn't seem to be moving very quickly through the city council. What's not written into this or the subtext to all of this is a reflection of a massive disappointment, I think, in the business community from the city council, and not from the city council's politics, more the city council's lack of activity in this regard, the lack of transparency on the $170 million that Seattle spends annually on the homeless problem and doesn't really seem to be making headway. And so this is essentially saying, you know what, we're going to do it ourselves through the initiative process, bypass the city council entirely, and require the city to do the listed things in this particular ballot measure.
Well, we have one of those CEOs and business leaders here with us, with you, Scott. And you had a startup operating in downtown Seattle when the pandemic hit. You decided to close your downtown Seattle offices, and then you didn't renew the lease in August. And now you're saying when you do get offices, you're not coming back to downtown Seattle. You were quoted in Mike's story saying, until there's a credible, durable solution to crime and homelessness in the downtown core, I think Seattle will have a hard time luring tech companies back. I mean, that's pretty blunt that you're not coming back even if they... until they maybe clean this up. Tell us a little bit more about your thought process around that.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, I think it's a mix of factors. And first of all, there's nothing about this that I'm personally happy about. You know, I've lived in Seattle for over 30 years in the Seattle area, and the bulk of it has been in Seattle proper as opposed to the east side. But what I've observed is just, I'd say over the last, particularly the last 5 to 10 years, an attitude in Seattle that I would characterizes anti-business and kind of anti-job. And that certainly has accelerated in the last few years. And it's unfortunate, you know, the head tax that was floated previously and then is still being talked about is one example of that. But then you add on to it just sort of like infrastructure problems, congestion, traffic congestion, congestion on city streets has gotten worse and worse. And then on top of that, layer in the homeless problem, but really less about the homeless, but more about the crime problem. As you'll probably remember, John, in January of 2020, there was a shooting that happened literally right outside my window. And our office was between Pike and Pine and stretched in the Gibraltar building between 4th Avenue and 3rd Avenue. And my office opened out on 3rd Avenue. And there was a shooting on the corner there. And the shooter literally ran underneath my office and was firing over his shoulder backwards. We could see the, you know, the bullet casings on the ground down there. And it wasn't that surprising because we knew that stretch had been just, you know, drug dealing out in the open, you know, police really not doing anything about it. And it kind of felt a little bit like a last straw anyway. And 2 months later, the pandemic hit. We sent our employees home on March 3rd, which I'm quite proud of. We beat Microsoft and Amazon to the punch by a couple of days. But once we adapted to working remotely, what I found is our workforce, although we miss getting together in person and we're eager to get back to that as soon as it's safe, there's really no burning need for us to rush back into an office. And I think when we add up kind of all of the things that you want to consider on where you want to be right now, the ledger is biased against Seattle in my mind, mostly because of the crime and, you know, just the sort of, I've got a lot of employees that don't feel safe in downtown. And then on top of that, the transit, you know, problems and stuff like that. And if you compare those factors to the east side, Bellevue, Redmond, Kirkland, and even down Renton, I think is going to do well. All of these areas are basically in competition with downtown Seattle, and I think they're going to benefit as a result of Seattle's problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there a scenario where you could see Ad Lightning go back into downtown Seattle?
Sure. I mean, in fact, you know, it'd be great if we felt like we could. But I think the first thing that would have to happen is we got to get through COVID completely because everybody on my team pretty much took transit to get downtown. And I think until people feel comfortable getting back on buses and trains, that is going to be a problem for downtown Seattle because it requires it. Now, that's not a problem that's unique to just to Seattle, but there's that. I think the other piece of it, though, is we'd have to feel confident that we're not going to have employees that would be at risk of getting shot while they're waiting to get on a bus, which is exactly not my employees, but a couple of Amazon people got, you know, hit with bullets in that incident that I mentioned on 3rd Avenue. I mean, that is just not something that we've seen in downtown Seattle, but it because we've now had that, we're going to have to see a scenario where that doesn't happen. And I also think that the city government needs to send a very clear signal that they want tech jobs in the city, not that they want us to go away, but they want us and they welcome us back.
Yeah. Mike, what's your take on this? Because it seems like there is a real divide between the City Council of Seattle and the business community here. Is that what you found through your reporting as well? And is this, how do you see that shaking out? And is it only resolved through elections and a new city council perhaps coming through?
I don't think so. I think a lot of issues are getting conflated. And that's actually an important point because if people see them all as one you know, universal thing, I think that they make decisions accordingly. But let's just look at the crime issue in downtown Seattle and the homelessness issue in downtown Seattle. There's been an approach, and in fact, I think somebody on the city council actually said that they are bothered by the fact that these two issues get conflated. There is a crime problem in downtown Seattle. There also is a homeless problem, and there is a, you know, an overlap, but not a massive overlap between the two things. But people who are walking in downtown, they see all the tents, they see the waste and things like that, and they assume that that's all one giant issue. If we are tougher on crime, for example, that's going to actually help this other thing that they're actually seeing. And it's not the case. So this effort here, I think, is specifically, and the one thing that they did here that was very smart is that they involved a lot of the nonprofits specifically who deal with these issues, from Evergreen Treatment to Plymouth Housing. I mean, these really are the stakeholders in terms of actually solving this kind of problem. Getting them involved was, I think, the real savvy political move, because then it cuts off the natural opposition, which is going to say at some point, this is another attempt to criminalize homelessness. And I think that they did a smart job on that. The other thing that they did that was very smart politically on this is they built it with that famous Boise versus Martin court decision in mind. the decision that said a guy who was arrested for sleeping, the Supreme Court ultimately held that you can't just pop someone for sleeping if you don't give them somewhere to go. That sleeping is effectively a human right. And so because of that, cities have had very schizophrenic ideas about how to deal with homeless populations. And Seattle kind of has been almost hands-off as far as it goes. And anyone who works in downtown or many neighborhoods could tell you the same. So I think I don't think that involves, you know, whatever the city council needs to do, because this process bypasses the city council entirely. What it is going to factor into, though, is the whoever becomes the next mayor. Because the nice thing about this from a reporting standpoint is that this is going to dovetail with the mayoral election, which is also going to be on the same ballot. And so I would imagine that this is going to be the biggest issue on the whoever decides to become mayor. They're either going to have to come out strongly against or strongly in favor, because this is not going to be a ballot measure that is going to leave people undecided.
Super interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that in terms of putting it on the same ballot with the mayoral race, which is very interesting.
It's a smart move. It's a smart move because it's really going to. And my guess is that this is just, you know, rumors that Bruce Harrell, former city councilman, actually briefly was mayor. He was mayor for a week, something like that.
5 days, right?
Yeah, something like that. He is actually probably going to endorse this thing. That's my guess. So you heard it here first, or don't blame me if I'm wrong.
Scott, when you looked over the initiative and the measures that they were putting in place, did this give you confidence that the city could finally pull something together that might work? Or do you think it's just another policy that's not going to make changes that would allow you to grow your business in downtown Seattle?
Well, you know, I'm certainly not as expert on it as Mike is. I haven't looked into it as deeply, but I absolutely agree that the homeless problem is separate from the crime problem. Now, I do think there is an intersection when it comes to, if you look at the root causes of homelessness, the root causes really are income inequality and drug and alcohol abuse. I mean, and that's, we've gotten presentations at our city council in Clyde Hill where experts have kind of told us about that. And so I think people, you know, that have those kinds of problems have got to get treatment, and they've got to get off the street if they're going to get into a better situation. So I'm, you know, having read what I have about the initiative, I think it's a great idea. I think hopefully it will make a difference. I'm also hoping that out of this stimulus plan that just passed, there's going to be money flowing to cities that may be able to be used to help solve some of the homeless problem. But there is a perception issue, I would say, for employees that are commuting in from the suburbs or someplace where they see a bunch of tents lined up. The photo that you guys used in your story is right around the corner from Pioneer Square Labs office where we started our company. And, you know, it didn't look like that 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, you know, there were folk, and there's a bunch of missions and stuff down there, but there weren't just sort of tent camps on the street, you know, permanently. I mean, it looks like something out of the 30s or something like that. And I think as a society, we have a moral obligation to try to solve it. So I think it's great that the ballot initiative is going to be tested and see if the city votes for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned you being a city council member in Clyde Hill, which is a suburb of Seattle on the east side. And when we come back from a break, I want to get into this debate of Bellevue versus Seattle and whether there is a migration of tech talent and companies from downtown Seattle to the east side. So we'll dive into that when we come right back from the break.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
All right, we're back. I'm joined by GeekWire's Mike Lewis and Scott Moore, the CEO of Ad Lightning. And before we broke, I mentioned how we were talking about this issue related to homelessness and crime and this deterioration really of downtown Seattle driving companies out of the downtown core. And a community that's benefiting from that is Bellevue. And we've seen this. There was a story this week in GeekWire on Amazon returning its workforce to its headquarters in downtown Seattle. But the subtext to that is a larger growing percentage of its workforce in the Seattle area is being shifted into Bellevue, which is about 10 miles to the east of Seattle. And I'm just curious, Scott, maybe you can weigh in here because you've lived in Seattle for a long time. You have a company in Seattle, but you do live in on the east side now, and you're contemplating where you're going to put your company next. How is this playing out when you think about your own company, whether you're going to be in Seattle proper or the east side? And how does it tie into these issues we're talking about today?
Well, I think when you're thinking about where you want to locate, there's a number of different factors you got to take into consideration. Where does your workforce live, right? So relative to where you're going to work, where do they live? What are the transit options for getting to and from work, which is obviously related to the where people live? And then what are the sort of amenities that you're looking for in terms of both the physical space, but also the neighborhood or the area around the office that you're going to look for? And, you know, 10 years ago, downtown Bellevue was a pretty sleepy place. You know, there weren't a lot of dining options. The downtown park was probably brand new, and transit was limited purely to buses. And it just wasn't very good. Now, when you look at ST3, once the downtown Bellevue train opens up, which is 2 years from now, it's in 2023 that opens up, you'll be able to take a train, the light rail to Bellevue and all the way out to Redmond, at least the Microsoft campus in Redmond, from Seattle very easily. And I think that that combined within all of these high-speed buses that are also being deployed for the east side, the infrastructure on the east side for transit is just robust compared to Seattle. Whereas in Seattle, you've got, you know, just before the pandemic, they started pushing all the buses onto the surface streets, which were already congested, right? So you basically get gridlock. So that's one huge advantage that the east side has. And I think that's a pretty durable advantage as far as I can see. Secondly, there's just an enormous amount of construction. Now, that's happening both in Seattle, but also in Bellevue. I mean, you look around downtown Bellevue, there are probably at least 12 major buildings that are under construction right now. And several of those I know are leased to Amazon. As I'm sure you guys are probably aware, there's this new, I think it's called the Spring Hill District, that's being built out in Bellevue. And Facebook just bought, REI built a headquarters there. And then Facebook came in at the beginning of the pandemic and bought it, and REI made something like $200 million on the sale. That just shows you how desirable those real estate or that location is from a employer standpoint. And there's a lot of amenities in that area. They're building in residential to go along with the office space. There's lots of restaurants going in there and that kind of thing. So it's at this point, it's still early days for that. But as I look out over the next few years, I think that the east side is just positioned to become more and more attractive as a place for people to work. It used to be just, this is where people lived, but everybody worked in Seattle, unless you were at Microsoft. But now it's becoming sort of a great place to both live and work. And then you go into Seattle when you want to, but you don't have to go in unless there's a reason for it. Everything else that you want to do is here.
So I presume when you do open up a new headquarters for Ad Lightning, it'll be on the east side?
Most likely. I mean, I think that's a few months away at this point. But yeah, I would think so. You know, and I look around Amazon. There's no question they're gonna have a huge number of employees in downtown Bellevue very soon. Facebook, like I said, has a big facility. Google has doubled down and is expanding their facility over here. And of course, Microsoft's out in Redmond. So there's a ton of tech companies here already, and that also makes it sort of conducive just from a talent standpoint. You know, if you want to recruit people that are already working at one of these other companies, and they only have to change their commute by 5 minutes, it's a benefit versus having to cross a bridge.
It does really seem, and, you know, Scott, I know we've been in the startup ecosystem for a long time here. It does seem that the pandemic has shifted the pendulum in the startup community, maybe to the east side more than it was, and in the just general tech ecosystem as well. And I know especially when Amazon first announced they were coming into South Lake Union in a big way, then everybody poured into Seattle and wanted to be in Seattle. But it does certainly feel like that is shifting. When you talk to your, you know, other founders and CEOs of startup companies, do you get a sense, like, is this something they're talking about? Or are they saying, hey, we're evaluating our office space needs? We're looking at different options. How prevalent is this when you're talking to your peers in the startup and tech community?
I would say that for the most part, people have been in a wait and see mode up to now. So I haven't really put the question of, you know, when we get out of this pandemic, are you guys going to, you know, relocate or locate in Seattle versus the East Side? I can't really answer that question because I think everybody has gone remote and is sort of saying, all right, we're probably going to go back in some fashion to an office, but maybe it's going to be a hybrid approach or something like that. But I don't know location-wise whether I haven't talked to my peers about that particular question.
Mike, what's your sense on how this is going to shake out, especially in light of the Amazon announcement this week when they said they're going to return to an office-centric culture? I think that was pretty interesting because a little bit different than what some of the other companies have announced here, like Microsoft and Zillow Group, where they've said, you know, we're kind of going the hybrid route where people are going to have more choice. Amazon is really going to drive back towards its office culture. I guess I'm not totally surprised by that because Amazon does things its own way. But what's your take on how that's going to play out and on this shift, especially as it relates to Amazon, which has 75,000 people in the Seattle area, and they're planning to have 25,000 in Bellevue? How do you see this playing out for the region? And what does it mean for politically for this area as we look at the public policy needs of the community?
Well, I mean, I think it means a few things. One, I do think that it's, you know, when you really think it through, it's hardly surprising that Amazon, a company that wants to track, you know, every employee's move, that has their employees, essentially their tech employees, working on this billable hours system, essentially, that you have to account and you're not allowed to add meetings to your billable hours, which is kind of funny, right? Because that inspires you to have short meetings. Again, something I'm a huge fan of. But if you're a company that wants to track everyone, you're going to want them in the office. So that does make some sense. But I would say on the to step back and make a larger assumption, if I were the folks in Bellevue, I'd be a little careful what I wish for. Remember that a lot of these companies located in Seattle, when one, Seattle had a lot of talent and had a lot of available space, but part of what drove Seattle to the condition it's in now, the income inequality, the disparity, the construction, and there's an important point to make about the construction. The construction removed existing low-end housing, right? The big buildings you see all over South Lake Union, you know, if you look at the Publix or the Morrison, all of these old kind of cheap hotels where people used to stay, those are some of the same strata of people who are now living in the streets. And so this great boom did force a group of people out. And I would say in Bellevue, you still have, it's a little bit more affordable in some places. It's still an expensive place, but what was it Danny Westy at the Seattle Times referred to as the prosperity bomb? If I were in Bellevue, I'd be concerned about that. And I would actually do a good job planning for that because I think Seattle paid a lot of attention to the prosperity end of that phrase, but not a lot of attention to the bomb end of that phrase until it was a little late. And so if I were them, I'd try to get out in front of this because you're going to run into the same problem Seattle did. When the fire hose of cash gets pointed at you, it's not always solely a good thing.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. And it's unpredictable, all of the effects of it. I mean, for sure, it's going to drive up real estate prices. So if you already own a home on the East Side or in Bellevue, you're probably going to benefit in that sense. But the biggest difference in my mind is just the transit infrastructure, really, because Seattle just is geographically constrained, right? And, you know, you think about the bus tunnel and the bridges that you have to cross to get, you know, into the downtown core. It's not that easy. Like, it's very constrained geography. From Bellevue, getting, you know, you can go east. You can also go north and south. I mean, you can really access a huge amount of territory. And with all the investment that's going into SD3, I mean, there's going to be light rail out in Issaquah a few years after the downtown Bellevue transit station opens. It'll go all, you know, it'll be extended out to Redmond downtown as well. So I think that if I look at this over several years, there's no doubt that there will be some displacement probably. But if the transit infrastructure does what it's designed to do, what's supposed to do, hopefully that'll mitigate it by being able to have people further out, be able to get in easily. And then also, you know, building out more density close into downtown Bellevue in these areas. I mean, Kirkland has just become much more dense than it used to be. And it know, it's got a ton of residential housing now in its downtown core. I think the planning that has been done by the governments on the east side has been quite good and has been anticipatory towards significant growth. And that did not feel like the case in Seattle, where I remember when I was working at Cheeseburger and we were in Lower Queen Anne, and I had to fight through the Mercer mess every day to get home. It was just insane. And it felt like all the time more lanes were being taken off the streets, you know, either to accommodate bikes, which as a biker I support, but or buses or whatever. But you ended up just, it felt like just kind of getting jammed down further and further. Whereas in Bellevue, the throughput is increasing, you know, as we go.
So why is it always that the east side is the preferred? I mean, I've got some thoughts about that, probably some of them not so popular, but why is it always the east side is preferred and people don't look south into Kent and into other areas like that that are even cheaper? You know, you've got a lot of, you actually have. I mean, where is Blue Origin located but in Kent? It seems to me like you've got a potential there that is maybe being underutilized at this particular point.
I will point to something we've reported on at GeekWire is, and Scott, you mentioned Renton, which is just south of Bellevue and closer to the airport. And there is a very large tech campus, which has been built down there called Southport. I don't think they've been able to fill it with tenants. Of course, they came online at a pretty rough time with the pandemic hitting, but there's an entire development there, very large mixed-use space geared almost directly for tech tenants. And so there is a movement, at least by some, to go south. This is the development that some may remember. There was a bold plan to run a passenger ferry shuttle between South Lake Union and the south part of Lake Washington to connect these two vibrant areas. But Scott, what are your thoughts on going south and the city expanding that way?
Yeah, I think that's totally viable. And I would consider Renton to be pretty much part of the east side too. I mean, you know, it's just a 405 and just south on the 405, right? Renton, I think Tacoma will benefit too. I mean, if you think about this regionally, right, which it really is, companies will go where, as I said, there's good amenities, there's good transit, there's restaurants and things around the office space that their employees want to take advantage of, and that are easy enough for people to get to and from, that it's not just a huge hassle. So, you know, I would say all of the communities that you guys have mentioned, Kent, Renton, even down to Tacoma, again, and I used to be a little skeptical about ST3, to tell you the truth, but I'm now seeing it play out in a way that will enable a lot more of that. It will be dependent on people, you know, not getting back in their cars and being willing to take trains and buses to get to and from. But if they are, then the infrastructure that's being built out now is going to disproportionately benefit those east side and south communities rather than downtown Seattle.
Mike, for our listeners, maybe a primer on ST3 and what it means. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that sort of transit plan in making the region more connected. Is this a good idea? Is it going to take root in this new world of work?
Wow. That's about five podcasts worth, right? I mean, ST3 is big, really expensive. ST3 is, at its most ideal, really terrific. It's expensive, but it's a really terrific way to intermodal transit, to link a whole bunch of kind of independently operating systems through the whole region. So I think that is, I completely agree with Scott. That is absolutely fundamentally important. I mean, one of the really interesting things, I mean, again, you guess you have to be a super transit nerd to care about this, but if you go back and look and read the history of BART in the Bay Area and how much people didn't understand how important, and now you would shut down the Bay Area if you did not have BART, right? It's that important. But at the time, it was considered this radical, overpriced nonsense because it was going to places where people weren't. Well, you know what happens with transit is if you put it there, that's where people are. And that's, I think, some of what Scott is saying, is that you literally dictate business and residential migration patterns where you put roads and alternately where you put rail and where you put, let's just say, even the ferry. And I think that there has also been a lot of talk at the state level that you mentioned the fast ferry from Renton to South Lake Union. There's a lot of talk about that. In fact, even the new Seattle hockey team has been talking about ways, because it's never going to meet its transit goals for Queen. We all know this, you know, for the new arena in Queen Anne, they're not going to be able to get to their traffic goals there. No, it's impossible in that area. But they've even embraced the idea of, well, what if we could move people around via water where we don't have to buy a right of way? It's relatively cheap as far as transit goes. And I think that that is actually going to end up being one of the real, it's not part of ST3, but it's really going to end up being one of the big changes, I think, in this area, that you're going to find a lot more water-based transit, because it is, you're building docks in two locations or several locations, but you don't have to pay for a single right-of-way. And that tends to be a very expensive process when you're doing transit.
Well, that is the Seattle Kraken. And I must remind you, they also were exploring delivering people to the arena, Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, by drone. This was also an idea. So that will absolutely have to be
I didn't know about
their podcast on how we're going to move people around the city, including to our great new NHL franchise. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to ask Scott a grab bag of questions, given his long history of entrepreneurship in the Seattle area, asking him about the funding climate, the media climate, maybe even NFTs. So stick around. We're going to have a fun conversation with Scott Moore of Ad Lightning when we come back. Welcome back. I'm John Cook, co-founder of GeekWire. I'm here with Mike Lewis of GeekWire and Scott Moore, the CEO of Ad Lightning. Scott, so we're going to kind of go into rapid fire here a bit. Your company, Ad Lightning, it's in the online advertising space. You just raised new funding. I'm just curious, what was the climate like out there for raising money? It seems like it's just a red hot market right now. So from a startup entrepreneurial landscape, what are you seeing out there?
Well, somebody that I respect very much used the word frothy with me a day or two ago, and I tend to agree with that assessment. I mean, if you look at the valuations in the public markets, right, and then look at valuations in real estate, and then look at all the stimulus that's coming in and the low interest rates. I mean, you know, it's good because I think rightly the government and the new administration is looking to get the economy fired up so that people get, you know, people that lost jobs can get their jobs back. But as a result, there is a lot of money available to invest in good ideas. So it's strong right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely hearing that across the board. So, Scott, one of the other interesting things in your background is that you're a former executive at Cheeseburger, which was the online meme generator. It ran a site called I Can't Has Cheeseburger and Fail Blog. It collected all these interesting memes from across the internet. And I'm just curious, I was thinking about this with your background just here recently, because it seemed like it was perfectly positioned for this idea around NFTs or non-fungible tokens, which are all the rage and hysteria today. What do you think of that market and as it may apply to digitizing and making permanent records of some of this internet culture that we see? Is there a business here? Is this a real thing?
I have to say I'm very NFT skeptical. And maybe I'm just not smart enough to figure it out or whatever. But, you know, part of it is because the nature of memes is a fascinating phenomenon, but they're kind of transitory. For one thing, right? And they also benefit from being shared. So, you know, think about the memes that were running around with the ship stuck in the Suez Canal. I mean, they were everywhere, and people would make their own and share them and stuff like that. Would you pay money to own one of those things? Why? Like, I just has no interest to, you know, to me personally. And I'm also skeptical just because, you know, if you've got a digital asset that's made up of bits, by definition, it's replicable. So, you know, I just don't know how. You know, it's not like a painting that was done by a grandmaster who's no longer alive that has a physical quality that you know, could be replicated in some other medium, but can't be directly replicated versus, you know, a piece of data that could just be basically put on a hard drive and, you know, post it up somewhere and go everywhere. So I know that's probably contrarian or I'm just not an enthusiast on the NFTs at this point. I'm skeptical.
Yes, I think people are saying maybe another tulip boom.
Exactly. It feels like it feels a little mania, like, you know.
Yeah. So the other interesting part of your background, and I know we've nerded out on this before. You and Mike were nerding out on transportation issues. So we've got three people who've worked in the media business here for a long time. You're the former president of MSNBC.com, former publisher of Slate magazine. What's your take on what's happening in media right now and the landscape as it exists? And where are you getting your media? And how do you see that evolving? You see some venture firms like Andreessen Horowitz playing a bigger role, investing in things like Clubhouse. Is there good opportunity in media right now? And where would you invest? And what are you interested in?
Yeah, it's always a complex and ever-changing environment, you know, media. There's no question about it. You know, things that I think are interesting now are like Substack and the ability for a, you know, say a journalist or a, you know, columnist or somebody that is a creator that traditionally would have had to work for a company that had a platform, that had a newspaper or, you know, television channel, whatever. Some of these people are now able to, Patreon's another example, create their own brand and monetize directly with an audience of followers. I think that's very interesting, right? That's kind of almost like applying the gig economy to the media business, you know, and giving, you know, individual people a way to build their own brands outside of big media companies. The other question that in my mind is really going to be interesting is what happens with Facebook and Google from a regulatory standpoint, because, you know, I think that Facebook, you know, certainly they negatively impacted Cheeseburger in a big way back when I was there, and that was in the sort of mid teens, I guess. If Facebook rolled over, we could either gain a ton of traffic or lose a ton of traffic. They have an enormous amount of power. And, you know, we see what's happening in Australia, the battle between Facebook and the Australian government. I think as Facebook gets regulated, what I'm hopeful for is that more of the rents, if you will be able to go back to media publishers and not be soaked up by Facebook and Google, who don't really create content. They just sort of ride along and monetize largely other people's content. So that's it. You asked me where I get my media. I mean, I have my Twitter feed pretty well tuned with a whole wide variety of sources, both individuals that I follow and then, you know, core media brands. I mean, I read the Washington Post, New York Times every day. I read the Wall Street Journal. I read GeekWire. You know, I have my favorites and stuff, but I like to try to get some serendipity in there too, and discover stuff that I haven't come across before.
Mike, what are your thoughts on some of what Scott touched on? I know you're a Substack fan. You read a lot of newsletters, and also the idea of Facebook maybe pushing money back to the publishers. We haven't really talked much about that. I'm curious where you come down on that as well.
The funny thing about Facebook is that virtually everyone who has been negatively affected in the media business by Facebook at one time walked into the chamber willingly. I mean, we all did. We all ran in, actually, and we fought for position. And then we realized that, wait, the door's locking behind us and now we're trapped and maybe we're going to get ruined in this process. And that's what happened when I was at AOL and working for its startup, Patch.com, where I was the regional editor here in Washington. I mean, it became a real nightmare to disentangle yourself from Facebook and to get Facebook to acknowledge the fact that it was essentially a giant parasitic organization on whatever advertising money you thought you were going to make, you're not making anymore. And so that was a drag. I don't know what they're going to do as far as Facebook regulation goes and Section 230. I mean, if Facebook had to start carrying liability for what people were posting, wow. Facebook wouldn't have probably ever started if that actually didn't exist. But does it need to continue like that? I don't know. I mean, my question for Scott is kind of a little bit more related to advertising, since that's what you do, and Apple. And I'm kind of wondering how Apple's privacy decision, how that is affecting a business like yours.
Well, that's a great question. And it's pretty early, so it's hard for me to give you a definitive answer. But I will say that we're confident that it's not going to have a negative effect on what we do. And that's primarily because our business, Ad Lightning, is around helping publishers as well as suppliers of ads. So companies that are SSPs or DSPs sort of in the supply chain of advertising, helping them clean out bad stuff that gets into their systems. The way that programmatic advertising works is it's essentially an open ecosystem that lots of people can put stuff into. And there are very few controls about what goes in. And then because of the nature of it being targeted, and currently via cookies, it's targeted. If all of us open the same web page right now, we'd be seeing different ads because our profiles look different. You know, if that changes to Flux and, you know, these other things that Google is working on, fine, it's still going to be targeted at some level. You know, it may not be targeted individually, but it's targeted at groups. And as long as there's still ways for malware and, you know, other bad actors to get access into that ecosystem, there's still going to be bad ads. So that's kind of our core business, is cleaning that kind of stuff out. So I don't really see that changing. The other thing that I will say about Google's moves is, for as long as I've been in digital media, which dates back, you know, 1994 at Microsoft, the predictions have been that cookies are going to die. Like literally that, I've heard that, I don't know, every 2 or 3 years it feels like, and that's never happened. Now, I don't doubt that Google's serious about this, but on the other hand, the only reason Google's making this move is because they're worried about getting regulated over privacy, and I hope they do. You know, and the moves that California has already made to put in the California Privacy Rights Act, I think is, and that was passed by ballot, not, again, you know, they bypassed the legislator. That's awesome. And I think we're going to see legislation. Our congresswoman here on the east side, Susan DelBene, is leading legislation at the federal level to protect user privacy. Those, to me, are going to have really big impacts and positive impacts, you know, on user experience and user privacy. And I don't think it has to destroy the ad business whatsoever. We need to get out of a scenario where every single action that each of us takes on a digital device is being captured and then shared with Lord knows who, right? We don't have any control of it. Most consumers have a vague notion of it. If they had any idea that every little banner ad that shows up on a web page that they go to, and there's probably 4 or 5 on every page, some of them have 300 or 400 JavaScript calls that are collecting data on them and putting them back into databases who they have no idea where that's going, people would be appalled. And I think there's a rising awareness now among the public and among you know, politicians, that that's a problem that needs to be addressed.
There's legislation in Olympia, and like you were saying, DelBene's legislation as well. It feels to me like we're at a very significant sea change here in people, privacy, and the internet, because I think people are just now getting aware how much of a product they've been and how little they've been compensated for that product.
Right. If the product is free, you're the product. Right?
Bingo.
Well, this is a great segue. And I know we could have several more podcasts about privacy. But the reason why this is a good segue and teaser to next week is our scheduled guest for next week is Representative DelBene on the GeekWire podcast. So we're going to dive into this issue in a much deeper way next week on the GeekWire podcast. Until then, I wanted to say a big thanks to Mike Lewis of GeekWire for joining us and Scott Moore, the CEO of AdLightning. Thanks for joining us today.
Happy to.
Thanks, John. It was great fun.
And to see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com and sign up for our daily email newsletter to receive all of our stories. Our podcast producer is Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. We'll see you next week on the GeekWire podcast.